Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of the Loftus Party Podcast. No, I am not Michael Loftus. I am also not Stacey Linux. I am Kung Fu Rick, the guy behind the scenes pushing all the buttons, making it all come together. They are both unavailable this week. Don't worry, you're not going to have to put up with me for an hour. We're actually going to fire things off here in just a second with some of our favorite clips. We're going to lead things off with one of my favorite interviews with Kurt Schlichter. So let's fire up the Wayback Machine and away we go.
As promised, we got the one and only Kurt Schlichter here with us today on the Loftus Party. Hey, good morning, Kurt.
How you doing?
I'm okay. I'm not digging the weather. You and I, now here's what, we met briefly at a CPAC like 2 years ago, right? An insanely lame year. I thought it was going to be like just conservatives going nuts. It was very tidy. It was very low key, but we're both Southern California guys. I didn't know that about you. I don't know why. I always thought you were like an East Coast guy.
Oh God, no! I'm a Californian.
Now, are you born and raised out here?
I was born in Ohio, and then I moved to Northern California at like age six.
Okay, hold the
right
phone.
Near San Francisco.
I'm from Ohio. I grew up in Columbus, Ohio. Where are you from in the Buckeye State?
Cincinnati, home of weird chili.
That chili's the best. Cincinnati chili. Holy smoke. Okay. All right. So we won't regale people with stories of chili. I want to get into some hardcore meat. You've served your country. You're quite outspoken on Twitter, and you're an author. I don't even know where to start.
I'm a multi-talented Renaissance man.
A Renaissance man. So here's what I don't understand. And you're a practicing lawyer as well, yeah?
That is true. I do. I do the law thing.
And you're a poet? And you also tour with Cirque du Soleil.
Well, I'm a noted rapper.
What's your rap
MC
name?
MC Cool Slick. And... you know, I continually drop rhymes and bust moves. I have a lot of street credibility. I unite the East Side, the West Side, and the South Side. North Side guys? They can kiss my.
What I was about to say. It's those North Side people. They've really dug in. You can't even.
I know. Really, and their raps are lame and unimaginative and mostly revolve around what they had for lunch. A lot of food-based raps in the North Side.
Yes, they're all about that. And I've seen you at a lot of the MC battles in downtown.
And it's ugly. You know, you'll get in there and the North Side guys are just not good. He's like, yo, 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 I was eating hummus and you're dumbass.
Right?
No, that's not a great rap.
No, it's not.
And they rhyme falafel with careful. I just think that's lazy.
It is. It's lazy freestyle. And I hope someday we can bring the North Side people back into the MC battle fold. But I think sadly we have to give up on them now because it's just the fact that you've united the East Coast and the West Coast and the South Side. Is huge, and that, you know,
I build bridges. I'm an engineer. I'm the United Nations of hip hop.
Okay,
it's pretty
so
clear.
We have that in
MC
common.
MC Cool Slick.
That's old school, and I love it. Okay, I want to talk about Indian country. I was on Twitter last night scrolling through. There was some woman saying that she had just dove into Indian country. Is that your first book, your second book? What?
Oh, I don't even know what number it is. It's my second novel. The first one is People's Republic. And I'm actually writing a third called Wildfire. I'm about a third through it. And I have the cover. It is badass. And then I've got...
good, because like, that's how book. I judge.
Well, yes! Don't get me started on cover, because I have a publisher for the other one, Militant Normals, which is coming out in October. And that's nonfiction. And... ooh. You know, I'm going to write three books this year.
Okay, now this is one thing that fascinates me. I'm a stand-up comedian and a writer.
I was a stand-up. You seem pretty stable for a stand-up.
You know what it is? I don't like to crank it up. in the early morning hours. I save most of my comedy for the actual performance. Here's what I find insanely boring. If you've ever hung out with a comedian that doesn't have an off switch and they have to constantly try to prove how funny they are, that is tedious and boring, and I cannot stand it.
All the comedians I used to hang out, because we do like a thing at Victorville, and like four of us would go up there, and we'd be in the car, and my wife would be in the car, and they're like the least funny people.
Yes.
They're all like, I got a lot of personal issues. My mom's sick. Yeah. I don't have a lot of money for food. Yeah. And I was still a lawyer. I was still in the Army at the time, too. And I was like relatively, I just liked being funny. I was a much better writer than performer. And
yeah,
everyone wanted to write with me because I can, you know, I'm funny. And, but I would go out and I'd do shows with people wherever. And I had this group of friends who really wanted to be full-time stand-ups. And a lot of them were just sad.
Yeah.
A lot of them were like, I got a lot of personal problems. I don't know why. I was always happy. Maybe that's what made me not want to keep doing stand-up, or the fact that Uncle Sam made me come back on active duty.
Right. It was always a real bummer when you go out, you would go out on the road and you're like a happy-go-lucky guy, and you would be hanging out with like the bad luck schlep rocks of the world.
I think it's easier to be unhappy as a comic. Just like it's easy to, you know, if you're a girl comic, you know, hey, I got this tampon bit. Or, you know, if you're a guy, yeah, you know, what's the deal with chicks?
Hey,
and a lot of people would fall into their you know, comic stereotype. I remember people would push me, do lawyer jokes. And I'm like, no, I'm not a lawyer. A lawyer is just simply one of the things I do. I've got a lot of things I want to talk about. And, you know, though I did have some funny lawyer bits, it wasn't because I was a lawyer. It was because I always tried to be funny. I was funny before I was a lawyer. I was writing jokes in the 80s. You remember NTN? They you go to bars and they have those trivia questions.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I wrote the TV ones.
That's great.
Remember that? Yeah, they go in like, you know, what was McCoy's nickname in Star Trek? And then they'd have like a little joke about Star Trek. Hold on, I'm walking through the house and the dog's barking because I'm
a freaking kid. Is
that biting? Did bring his keys, so I'm on like a show opening the door for you. All right, that's my woke 8-year-old.
Oh, is he one of those that like, you know, I asked my dad this morning if I could go to the protest with him, and
yeah, I asked my dad, why does Trump hate young Guatemalan immigrants seeking a new life away from economic and terrorist hardship?
Those are my favorite
tears in his
tweets.
Eyes.
Those
I
are my
love
favorite.
Those.
Hey, so really quickly.
Mine's all more like, you know, single malt. Dad, why do some people drink, you know, single malt?
how will the tariffs hurt the bourbon
exactly
industry?
Dad,
so hey, did you ever do stand up?
How's the aluminum tariff regimen going to affect America's trade relations with Norway?
My 4-year-old was asking me that last night. It was crazy.
Exactly. It's
did you ever do stand up at Go Bananas?
Okay. Let's see. I did the Giggle Works.
Yeah.
The Chuckle Barn, Laffy's, Chuckleys.
There was a great club in Cincinnati called Go Bananas, and it was fantastic. It was like in the basement.
I never did anything on the East Coast.
Okay. All right. So you came out west, and you you've done the
at age six.
At age six. Wow. So yeah.
Yeah. I couldn't take Ohio. People were open and genuine there, and I had to get away from that.
Okay, so I want to get back to the writing, because like it's all I can do to like churn out a 44-page sitcom. That's like a lot of work. I really, really admire people who write books. How do you handle the full-time job of being a lawyer? And I know you do Fox News a bunch. You're on a lot of those shows, and now you say you're writing 3 books this year. Do you have like a writing partner or an assistant? How do you do it?
Well, my wife reads every night. So, but no, I look. I was in the Army. I was a colonel in the Army. I know how much time I fill up every minute. It's very rare that you'll see me just sitting. Even while I'm tweeting, I'm still building the brand, writing jokes while I'm sitting. Now, I think writing a good sitcom would be harder than writing a novel. Writing a novel is not hard. It just takes time. Because
oh,
I, I, I write everything in my head before it even gets on paper. I do that in court too. I've won most of my court cases, you know, walking the dog or jogging around. Yeah. And when you're putting stuff on paper, that's the end of the process. Well, not the end, because the end is editing, but the end of that, that's not the beginning of the process. But a sitcom is different because you're first of all, you've got to make every line hit.
And that's really tough.
Yeah. It's like a set. It's writing a sitcom is a particular kind of script. Now, I've written script. I've had a script optioned. It was about zombies. It was great.
Fantastic.
You know, it could have been made for like $50,000, but I never got around to making it. In any case, but no, when you're writing a sitcom script, you're going to have to do, you know, every line has to be something. It's like my town hall stuff. I write my town hall stuff like a stand-up set. There's no fat. I don't do intros. It's your setup, punch or tag.
Yeah.
And that's what you're doing with a sit-up, a sitcom script. But if you read my town hall stuff, you'll see I write like a stand-up. Look at the structure of each sentence. The joke, if I do it right, occasionally I'll read through and I'll go, dang, I didn't do it right. The joke lands at the end of the sentence, not in the middle.
Yeah, and I didn't even mention the town hall column. That thing is wildly popular. Seriously, dude, and I'm not trying to blow smoke, but like, what time do you get started? I just don't think I have I need to attend the Kurt Schlichter School of Time Management.
I don't feel like I'm busy. I only do things I like, so it makes it easier. I'm 53. You know, I'm retired out of the military after 27 years. I've been a lawyer for 25. I'm at the point in my life where I don't do things I don't like. So, and I feel like I've got plenty of time to do stuff. I stopped and we watched a terrible movie on Netflix for a couple hours last night and laughed at it and shot jokes. I don't even remember what was it called?
Honey?
The movie we watched last night. It was like Troy and it had the crack in it.
That's fantastic.
Because there's no Troy. Like the crack. And my son's like, isn't that my woke 8-year-old? He's like, isn't that Norwegian mythology? I'm like, not, they're rolling. And of course, then they had to get to where they're going. Odysseus had to go home by the paths of the dead. And I'm like, wait a minute, that's Lord of the Rings. Wait, what are you doing? They like took all this stuff. And the highlight was they had this hot girl who was like, because there's always like a hot warrior girl now
you
for
need
some
that.
Reason.
That's necessary.
Right? And she's wearing like a little leather skirt, which you would think is hot. But underneath, really obviously, she's got bike shorts.
That's hilarious.
We're just rolling. But yeah, you know, I had like 2 hours that I had time. I didn't. No, I've got to be typing out more of Kelly Turnbull's adventures in, you know, Blue America, which I'm going to do later this afternoon.
Holy smoke! Now here's the other thing that I just because obviously I do my research. Research is job one. But you're also don't you have a show on CRTV?
No, it's Rebel. I do it once.
Rebel TV. I knew it was one of those. Like I said, research is job one. How often do you do the show on Rebel?
Just once a week.
Just once a week.
Yeah.
Dude, seriously. You're like, are you still like on army time? Is it like, it's like 6 a.m. get up. I just finished a pilot that I'm turning in. And I feel like I've worked so hard.
Oh, you have. If it's worth turning in, you have. No, I know what it takes to vacation. That's, you know, just make sure every line is gold. That's the tough thing. Every line's got to be gold.
Well, here's and it's too funny. One of my buddies now who's writing on Roseanne used to write on the old Roseanne show and got out of sitcoms like 2004, 2005. He got out of sitcoms and he started doing dramas. And he's like, dude, dramas are so easy. Like dramas are so much easier than sitcoms.
Comedy's tough because you're seeking a reaction. It's like trial lawyer. I'm seeking a reaction from 12 people in the box who couldn't talk their way out of a jury. you're looking for an so when if you're doing stand up, you're getting laughs. I mean, Twitter is like that too because I get instant feedback. That's why I do it. It's my Sudoku. You know,
dude,
some people are like, I want to do a puzzle.
Hilarious.
Well, I just love writing jokes. I always have since I was a little kid. We had a very funny street, and you know, you got street cred if you were funny.
Yeah.
People appreciated that. Greg Gutfeld actually grew up in the same town I did at the same time.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I probably ran into him cruising the El Camino in San Mateo.
Wow. Wow, that's crazy. But, okay, Go ahead.
But no, I mean, it's and you have to get a sense of how to write a joke.
Yeah,
it takes a while. I never had a systematic approach to it. I did it for years and years. And then I fell in with a guy named Greg Dean who did like comedy workshops. So I broke up with this chick because her dog died and there was nothing left, no reason to talk to her. So I started doing, I'm going to try stand-up. So I go to a stand-up workshop, guy named Greg Dean, and he actually sketched out how a joke works. And I understood instinctively. I didn't know how to do it in words.
Yeah.
And I mean, I didn't have a system for thinking. I'm like, that's what I've been doing. And, you know, after that, I started getting, I didn't make a lot of money, but I got a lot of people wanting to write with me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's too funny. It's like one of the guys that I started out doing stand up with back in Columbus left a really good law. I find lawyers are good. Lawyers are good stand ups. It's weird. There's like something, whatever drives people into like, I'm going to be a trial lawyer. I guess it is a performance. They're both performances of sorts. So there's like a weird genetic thread there. Now, your Twitter feed is very funny.
Shamelessness.
a very shameless. Look at me. Look at me and expect something wonderful.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So, no, hey. I mean, you got, look, I was a cavalry officer, which is the most flamboyant branch in the Army. We operated ahead of all the other guys. And we were operating in small groups. So we were very, and we had our Stetsons. And cavalry guys have been a good opinion of themselves, high opinion. I was the, and then trial lawyer. I mean, you literally have people going, this is my life savings. This is my business. And I'm putting it in your hands. And you have to believe you are the best or you will be, you know, disavowed.
So
you get up in front of an audience, and while I respect it was like, okay, worst case, I'm not going to get any laughs. I'm going to be pissed at myself. That's the air trauma of stand up. 50% of the time, you are below average. Half the time, you are going to say, crap, I could have done a lot better. You will always say, I could.
That's the worst feeling.
There's a great tweet I wrote today. I said, my woke 8-year old. I was with my woke 8-year old, saw Stormy Daniels on the TV because we were in an airport, put down his drink and said, strippers are just tacky who won't commit. And people were just howling at how funny that was. I thought it was funny. And I looked at it and I go, shouldn't have said drink. I should have said something specific.
Yeah.
Right?
Chocolate. You know? Yeah. Yeah.
you gotta be specific, preferably with a K sound.
Oh,
put
my
down
God.
As chocolate milk would have been funnier.
You got the case out of the chocolate milk. Coco. There you go. You've doubled up on the case.
Oh, man. That's like triple Yahtzee word score, Scrabble word score. But you know the feeling, right? You tell a joke, you're like, God, I could have really crushed it.
Oh, it's
or you think worst. Of something to top it off with, and you're like, damn it.
Yes.
But it's so challenging. I don't want to go, it's the hardest thing in the world. It's not the hardest thing in the world. Stopping a guy with arterial bleeding after he's been shot in the gut with a AK-47, that is much harder, and that's not something I've done.
And not as funny.
Challenge, and it's nowhere near as funny.
Okay, so here's what I'm trying to do with my little Loftus Party YouTube channel, podcast, blah, blah, blah. I'm trying to win hearts and minds with comedy. I'm trying to disarm people and go, oh man, I'm just having some fun with you. We're just having some laughs, and hopefully get people to view issues in a different way. I don't feel I'm wasting my time, but it's a long-term strategy.
Yeah. Look, Andrew Breitbart, who like most of the rest of North America was a friend of mine. He was a friend of everybody's. He was very clear, and I really agree with him, that you've got to be funny first. You got to, when you're doing art and you want to get a message, you got to get the art part first. So if you're funny, you can start doing stuff. The thing about comedy now is there's so many areas that you're allegedly not supposed to explore, and I can just feel it. It's like a giant pustule. Eventually someone's going to squeeze it, and we're just going to have this burst of rebel comedy where they're talking about the things that you're not supposed to talk about now: race, sex, transgenders, whatever. I see a lot of people who are trying to use comedy to teach and to help people grow gentle laughter that helps us share. I would literally rather blood and glass than have a gentle comedy.
I put a set up on the YouTube channel last week. I was out at the Brea Improv, and I came out as a Trump supporter, and it was hilarious. It's hilarious, and it was like you could just feel everybody in the room just be like, oh, it's okay, it's okay.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
look, I'll tell you what,
the first guy who pops the zit's gonna have pus all over him, but a lot of success.
Well, it's people, the majority of the audience just howling with laughter, loving it, and a couple people looking at me with shock. And I'm getting so many people that are like warning me. I came out as a Trump supporter, dude. I was on Varney. I was on Varney and Company on Fox Business. Nice. They just wanted to confirm that I actually voted for Trump. It's crazy.
Well, look, the thing is, if I were still doing comedy, and I'm not allowed to, my last set was one where I got in a fight on stage with Tom Arnold.
Oh boy! Okay,
he's just dumb.
He's making news. Sad. Making news. He's got the key to it all.
Well, that was like 13 years ago. I've like not done it since. Though I do jury closings much like a stand-up set. I also do without jokes, but it has the same feel, and you can see the structure. But I also do when I do public speaking things. I will have a high. I probably don't have a 7 last per minute rate, but I probably have a 2 or 3.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's such good training for doing other things.
There is
because it's a way to express yourself because you're in communication with the audience.
Yep.
And if I were doing a Trump bit, of course, the first people I would seek out are the ones in the audience who are sitting there with their arms folded, scowling. They're the ones I want to talk to. Everybody out there, the guy agreeing with me, I don't care about. Young lady, you seem really upset that I like Trump. Are you another of the ones that Trump banged and dumped? Because I got to tell you,
we're all going to meet at the Roadway Inn in Victorville and console each other.
Oh, my God. I've done the Roadway Inn in Victorville.
I was making it up.
I have done the Roadway Inn in Victorville.
I was making that up. I think it's hilarious.
No, I've done the Roadway Inn in Victorville. It's a great thing because you could do like, hey, man, we're here in Victorville, not like those suckasses in Barstow.
All right. Kurt,
you know, do 20 minutes on meth crazed weirdos living in abandoned mines out on the edge of town. And they're like, I know how you feel. That's my Uncle Mort.
Five people in the back of the room get up and leave because you've hit too close to home.
I know. It's like sometimes comedy hurts.
All right. Kurt, I want to thank you for being on. Hopefully we can get you on again in the future. What's the title of your next book? What's the next one you're working on?
Militant Normals. It comes out in October from Hachette.
All right.
And,
so
it's a real book.
That's I'm in awe, and I celebrate everything. People go out and get Kurt's book. Start cutting lawns now, saving up for his new book. That
pre-order
comes out.
Pre-order that sucker. Get my numbers up.
All right, Kurt. Thank you so much. I'd love to have you back on. It's too much funny. I will see you. I'll see you at the Roadway Inn in Victorville.
The Roadway Inn. Who's opening for who? That's the, that's the question.
Welcome back with me, folks. Again, I am Kung Fu Rick, hanging out and hanging in for both Michael and Stacy, who are out this week. Hope you enjoyed that interview with someone who I consider a really great guy. That was Kurt Schlichter. Up next, we have a segment they did together with none other than Mudflap Steve McGrew, who has actually done some comedy work with Michael in the past. So let's fire up that Wayback Machine, and away we go yet again.
What about the other thing that might be gone from school? Remember the booby?
No.
Remember that?
Was that what?
Yeah.
What is that?
What? Well, you'd pinch a boob.
Yeah.
Do you don't remember that?
We never had that.
You never had that?
That's legitimately assault.
It's a boob bee.
Oh, a boob bee. We had what's worse than a hurricane?
Yeah.
Titty twister.
And then you twist it. See, but that was probably
usually
gone too.
That was usually dude on dude. I never went up to a girl and like, what's worse than a hurricane?
We all did. I think it was an excuse for a grope back then.
Oh, God.
Hashtag
me
too.
The worst is the bra snap. Sorry, guys.
The bra snap, yeah. I wonder if those are gone.
Well, that's how you showed a girl you liked her when I was a kid.
Well, we would just dunk her pigtails in the ink bottle.
Oh,
there.
Yeah. Thank, thank you, Little House on the Prairie.
Right. Okay, so there's a lot going on. We're gonna jump into some news. I think. Well, let's. How do we want to frame this up? The Tucker Carlson thing. I think that's blown over. I think he's given. I think Tucker has given a lesson in how to do this. Because by day two of that thing, he was on the offensive. Is he still? I haven't. I got to be honest. We were in Cincinnati two nights ago. Last night, big team meeting, yada, yada. I haven't seen news in a couple of days.
Well, he stood up to the outrage mob more than anybody has.
But he went after Media Matters, who started the whole thing.
Yes.
Yeah, he went after their president. Apparently, Angelo, who heads up the entire rage machine, had some very interesting blogs that he'd written several years ago. So actually, even in my estimation, worse than anything Tucker said, when you take everything Tucker actually said in context. But yeah, Angelo is kind of a derp, and I think they went a little bit quiet. But then they had, you know, your AstroTurf protesters out in front of Fox News because they want the whole thing shut down. They're going after the hosts one at a time, but they literally want Fox News taken off the air.
Yeah, that's I mean, it's like they're playing hot potato over there. It's either they're either going after Hannity or they're going after Tucker or they're going after Judge Jeanine.
Yeah.
Or who's the other one that they go after all the time to have them taken off the air? Either way.
Well, it's every one of them. And they've had
Laura Ingraham.
They pick them off like birds on a wire. I mean, some of the Bill O'Reilly, boom, gone.
Well,
you know, but I'm saying they're picking them off. They're like, you know, seriously, bing, got one, bing. And I think that's actually hurt Fox News. I mean,
really?
Seriously, I do. I know I'm a news junkie. You and I have talked about this, but I know people that are now turning away because they're like, well, my favorite's gone. My favorite, it might not be your and I favorite, but they're like, well, you know, I don't watch anymore because such and such is gone.
I tell you, if you can separate, this is weird, and I've done videos about this before. If you can separate Bill O'Reilly's behavior, right? This is literally like Roseanne.
Right.
Take away that tweet. Can you still laugh at her joke? Bill Cosby, take away his thing. Can you still laugh at his jokes? Take away Bill O'Reilly and the lawsuits and the settling out of court. To me, that dude was it was an opinion show, but at least he did legit news.
One of the things that I think people have not been able to do lately is separate the art from the artist.
Right.
You know, like you could go, I can't read Edgar Allan Poe. He was a drug addict.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So,
well, that's like with going after Tucker. I mean, like he's saying this stuff on Bubba the Love Sponge. It's a shock jock. Like you can't go, oh, this is Tucker Carlson's deeply held beliefs.
Yeah.
This is what he argued in front of the Supreme Court in 1880.
He wasn't on the 700 Club.
Dig it. Dig it.
Well,
Tucker.
That would be like going back and taking every lefty politician in New York and a bunch of other people and coming through Howard Stern. I mean, for a while, Howard Stern was top of the frickin' market.
Yeah, absolutely.
And people said outrageous things on his show.
Well, that's what you went to do. You specifically went on Howard Stern to say the most outrageous thing. You knew that's what you needed to do. You prepared for that.
You know what would be interesting to find out, and this is just for people to know, I wonder how Howard's doing. I wonder how his show
the
is doing.
The actual ratings?
Yeah. I mean, it's XM satellite radio, so I'm sure they guard that like Netflix. But I'd love to know.
Well, if you've been watching, there was he had a new producer come in that told him don't do this, don't do that, get rid of like don't spank strippers' bottoms anymore.
Oh
like,
wow!
Yeah, it's a whole different show than when he was king of the media.
Oof!
That seems like taking your brand and flushing it down the toilet.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's just an observation from the corner over here.
Yeah, if Howard's not going to be spanking strippers, I was never.
What do you mean you can't pick up a midget and hit him in the boobs anymore?
A buddy of mine was like the biggest Howard Stern fan. He's like, you gotta hear this. And I was just like, whatever.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. Well, but wouldn't you, seriously, Mike, wouldn't you love to have somebody do for you what they did for Stern? Like just call up a show and go, instead of Baba Booey, just go, Michael Loftus, and hang up.
No.
Remember they did that for so long. People would call into talk shows, Baba Booey.
I know.
And hang.
I wouldn't want that.
You wouldn't want that? No.
Here's what I would want. Okay. I want people to call in and go, you know what? I never thought about this issue like this, but there's this comedian, Michael Loftus, and I would want that. I would want that.
Oh.
But I don't want the.
But you wouldn't like a mob that was so, no. Like, loved you so much that they were just like.
No, it would scare me. I wouldn't want it. They'd attack me at an airport. Baba Booey! And I don't know. And you got to act like you like them.
I don't know. You might be on the road now, Michael, after this week.
That was, I guess we should address that. The presidential tweet, which was just.
By name.
Which was awesome.
Mm-hmm. Now, was I the first one to show you that? Because I was watching and tweeting you that morning. Remember, we were texting. And you wrote back, holy hell.
Yeah. Actually, it was Brian Kilmeade and then you. It was like a 1-2 punch. I
was late to the party. That sucks. I texted you, holy crap, you just got retweeted by the president.
I really couldn't believe it. Like I got, Fox is very nice. They send a car in the morning and I always accept the offer because in a doomsday scenario, there's two people in the car and we can use the carpool lane. I don't want to risk if I'm going to get up at 2:30 in the morning to go do this. Yeah. I'm not going to risk getting stuck in some freak traffic thing. So I did the segment. It's weird. I feel like I am kind of like beating the same drum, like of how the left just dominates late night. The left just dominates political comedy. They just dominate and
they dominate media.
Yeah, and they don't want to – well, especially in the joking aspect of it, you know. So I was kind of doing that again and trying to figure out how to say that in a new way. And then I made a couple, like, little jokes, and man, oh, man, I guess the president liked one of them. What I love about it is that he actually tweeted the joke. Like, he wrote it down.
Yeah,
like
the crumbs.
Yeah. He didn't just like grab.
What should feel really cool is thinking you made President Trump either laugh or smile.
Or you know what? This thought hit me last night. There is a very legit chance that he watched the show and he's like, okay, so this guy's a conservative comedian. Let's see. And then he was like, ooh, that's not funny. Ooh, that's not funny. Ooh, what's the closest thing he had? I'll do that one.
Oh, golly, where do you go to these dark places?
I have self-esteem issues.
Wow, you really do. Forget daddy issues.
It's almost like I need to go out in front of a room full of people
every night
and have them approve
you
me.
You need to be validated. I know that feeling.
So it was very cool. I'm glad that. Everyone keeps expecting, oh, did your Twitter blow up?
Did it?
I'm like, no. I mean, from friends going, the president just tweeted you, blah, 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 blah. And then I kind of reposted it. But, like, he just wrote Michael Loftus. He didn't know to use my Twitter hashtag, the Loftus party.
Didn't a lot of people do what I did, though? Because I retweeted you several times with the Loftus party.
Yeah.
To tie it together.
Yeah, I got some new followers that way. But, yeah, it wasn't like our friend Terrence Williams, who's on this tour with us, he was telling us about when Hannity tweeted him.
Mm-hmm.
Hannity's like, oh, you got to check out. And then he used Terrence's Twitter handle. And Terrence was like, it was bonkers.
Yeah.
It was bonkers. And oh, my gosh. Last night I was talking social media with Stacey. Do you follow Brandon Tatum, Officer Tatum? He's with Turning Point.
I'm not sure if I do or not. It sounds familiar.
He was not a Trump supporter, and he was a police officer, I believe, in Tucson. And he's because Terrence got injured, Terrence got in the car accident. Brandon is doing a couple shows with us, and the guy's great.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a huge fan, and he knows Candace Owens and Charlie Kirk and all those kids over at Turning Point. He was telling me a story last night. We went out for pizza, and he was talking about He didn't think Trump was all that in a bag of chips. Very, very familiar little story to our podcast listeners. So he went to a Trump rally and was just like instantly just like, yup, this is the man.
It was like a tent revival.
Yeah. And he did a video about it like in the parking lot. And he's like, that's the one that just like just went crazy. And his phone, he said his phone for like 5 days straight. Just like new alert, new alert, new alert, new alert.
Yeah.
That's got to be exciting. That's got to be a cool feeling.
You know what's kind of weird? It's been great that he was able to turn that into a bigger and massive follow to keep it going.
Yeah.
The one of the first videos that I did as Liberal Larry was like blew up, went viral, like close to 8 million.
Yeah.
And then everybody was like, well, great, but the follow up, let's see how people can have a viral video. And then you go, why did that one take off and the next one didn't? And why does the next one only get 100,000?
What were you talking about? What was Liberal Larry talking about?
The election, like when Trump won.
Oh, like, I remember that video.
Remember that video? Crying, you're having a big meltdown.
Yeah. Well, that's why.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah, but you thought, okay, if they know you're a comic, wouldn't they start like staying with you or stalling your videos?
I have to think. And this goes back to branding. I think a lot of people legitimately thought Larry was real.
Yes.
I'm not kidding.
There's actually a woman that does that.
Yeah.
I forget what she goes by on Facebook, but she actually is a conservative, kind of like that account I love, Tatiana McGrath, which we found out this week is actually a guy.
Yeah.
Like, people respond to that account, and they think it's real. They can't tell it's a parody.
Yeah. Well, that's what happens. A lot of people who follow my Liberal Larry character in videos say they follow because they like to watch the response from people that don't know.
Oh, my gosh.
They like to read those comments. They say it cracks them up. They're like, I can't believe these people are this stupid.
And, like there would be a guy, a Democrat, who was like, you know what my YouTube channel is going to be? Liberal Larry. Like, it's like, you wouldn't just call it like Larry Dierkowitz or whatever.
Yeah, that's true. Well, you know, for a weird...
Because I'm Republican Mike.
For Republican Mike. Because I tried that for a while. Well, I did Liberal Larry at first, and I thought exactly what you said. And I changed his name to Larry Musk.
Larry Musk.
I put Larry Musk.
That's hilarious.
And for a while, it was Larry Musk. And then people were complaining, like, why did you change his name? What happened to Liberal Larry? Like, I can't find Liberal Larry anymore.
Oh, man.
So I went back to.
Yeah.
Because I thought the same thing. If people didn't see, they saw a real name, they might take the confusion a little further, you know.
Yeah. He's like an AM talk show guy that does nothing but characters, and he will have the most outrageous. One guy owns a steakhouse, and he's the most racist, old school.
Yeah.
And, like, people call in, and they believe it's real. What is that guy's name?
I know exactly who you're talking about. I used to listen to him in L.A.
He was hilarious.
He had the woman who was head of the HOH. And the...
Have you heard of this guy, Stace?
No, I haven't.
Oh, you got to look him up.
He does all the characters. He's the host, and then he'll call up. I'm going to call up Roy McGregor, owner of, you know, the blah blah steakhouse in Beverly Hills. And then he has like a filter or something because it sounds like
Phil Hendry.
Oh my Lord.
He had a
genius.
One time my son and I were listening to it. He had this guy, he was pretending to be a guy that wrote a book about how to make your children love you more. So he's interviewing, and the guy said, here's what you do. You put raw meat in their swimsuit, raw bloody meat in their swimsuit, and you put them out in the ocean. And when the sharks come to eat your child, you save them, and they're so appreciative that they love you more. And people went nuts.
Remember that with that little Cuban kid hiding in the closet and then during the Clinton administration?
Yeah.
There was a guy, he interviewed a, you know, air quote, guy who had a pop-up book about that kid.
Oh, my God.
And he was a little effeminate, and he was like, so here we see him. He's on his way to America, and there's him and his family on the raft. Then you pull this tab, and you got a little wave that comes. There goes mom and dad. He's all by himself. It was hilarious.
God.
People are just horrified. How could you do that? Who publishes the book? And he had a name of a fake publisher. Well, anyway, Phil Hendry.
Here's the thing about Phil Hendry. As weird and out there as that comedy is and dark, he blocked me on Twitter because of being a conservative. That's the other thing that bugs me about the left. That they can be as dark and twisted as they want to be.
Because it's art.
It's art.
Yeah. But when you do it, it's hate speech.
Yeah.
Yes. And that is why – that's why this is great. It's come full circle. And that's why we're doing the deplorable tour. Someone has to establish legitimately a beachhead.
Right.
A beachhead of we are comedians. We talk about this. It's just jokes.
Yeah.
It's not –
I've said I see the deplorables guy, us, the tour, Mike and Brian and all of us, actually becoming the conservative network. You know, like people will go, those guys should have a conservative Saturday Night Live type of show. Or those guys should have the conservative talk show. Like there needs to be that wave. These are the first of the conservative guys, and you can get behind this.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, like we got to be, you know, putting the flag on the beach. Okay, first things first.
Yeah.
We're going to start touring around the country, and we're telling jokes, and we're going to get that going. And then it's very similar to, and I think about this a lot, dude, a lot, National Lampoon.
Yeah.
Like National Lampoon, those guys that were just going to start making fun of
the college magazine that blew up.
Well, just making fun of the rich and the hoity-toity and, you know, the class differences. And then they found, Belushi and – I'm not saying in no way, shape, or form am I saying that we are like Belushi and Aykroyd and all those guys.
Yes, however, yes.
But they found those dudes and they started doing comedy albums. They didn't do touring. But like, okay, then after that happened, then you do a movie and you do another album.
And that turned into Saturday Night Live. And
Saturday
Night Live turned into characters that made bigger movies. And
everything, dude, there's a great documentary. I can never remember the name of it. I saw it on Netflix, Drunk, Stoned, and Weird, something like that. And it's about the founding of National Lampoon.
Yeah.
Everything you're laughing at today or for the on television, films, like 90% of it you could directly tie to National Lampoon in like 1978. Like that original group of dudes.
Yeah.
They changed films. They changed movies forever. But you had to start. Well, hopefully that's what we're doing out here on the road.
The cover of the gun to the puppy's head is iconic.
Yeah. Buy this magazine or the puppy dies. Whatever. So that's what we're doing. We had we're kind of all over the board, but I like that. This is like a treat. This is like a candy bar podcast right now. We did where the hell were we? Cincinnati the other night. That was a great show.
So they loved it. They cheered at everything. Not only did they clap and laugh, there was cheers.
Stacy, Gypsy, Gimlet, I can't wait till they're holding on to a bunch of this footage. They want to be very careful about how they release it and stuff, but I cannot wait for people to see. You won't believe the audience reaction. It is over the top. It's fantastic.
And when the show was over the other night, the audience actually broke into simultaneously, God Bless America.
This is crazy. Okay, so after the show, we stick around because there's like VIP packages and those guys, we take pictures, we hang out and we talk. So there's the VIP line, and as we're taking pictures, you can hear the audience out in the street, out in front of the theater, and they're God bless America. They're singing it so loud you could hear it in the theater.
Yeah.
It's just like this spontaneous. It was freaking.
Like they like came out America loving just sons of.
It was like it was like a movie. It was like a movie.
And there you have the one, the only Steve Mudflap McGrew. Really funny dude. If you have not checked out his Larry the Liberal stuff, you really, really need to do that. All right, so up next we have one of Michael's favorite interviews, Mr. Nick Searcy. Last time in the way back, folks. Here we go.
As promised, you guys, we got Nick Searcy with us. Now, before I even get to talking with the man, an amazing – go to this dude's Wikipedia. Go to this dude's IMDb page. We're talking Days of Thunder, Prince of Tides, Castaway, which I just saw recently, which amazing performance in that. The Ugly Truth, The Last Song, Moneyball, The Shape of Water, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing. This dude is Nick Searcy. He's an actor. He's a director. He's a filmmaker. He's a provocateur on Twitter. Nick, thanks for being here, man.
I'm also a really bad golfer. You forgot that.
All right. A really bad golfer. Fantastic.
Nice to be with you, Michael.
Okay, now I got so much stuff. I don't even know where to ask. So we're gonna go with the big one here.
Just relax. Don't be nervous. I know how excited you must be to speak to me, but you know it's normal. People feel like this all the time. Just relax.
I'm gonna try. I want to talk about. You've directed two films. You directed a piece in 95, which I'm guessing you did that on film, right? That was like an old school film camera, right?
Yes, we shot that on 35 millimeter film back before the digital age. Yeah.
Okay, so that's stress. That's a high level stress. Now you've got a new film coming out, Gosnell. You're all finished up on that. You wrapped a couple years ago, but now you've locked in a distribution deal. What was your experience like on that one? That's a bit bigger, yeah?
Yeah, it was a little bigger budget for me, and it was a great experience. Just I love directing. I love the thrill of trying to make a movie that way. It's kind of like being in a war. not to denigrate soldiers, but I mean it's a battle every day to get the thing done. And I'm very excited that it's finally coming out. There was a while there when I thought that it just might never surface because it's a very controversial subject, and I think the producers had some difficulty getting a company to release it.
Well, in case you don't know, Gosnell, a big abortion doctor, right, in Philly?
Yeah. Well, basically, he was a murderer. He just...
Yeah.
You know, the fact that he happened to be an abortion doctor was just the way he went about things. I mean, he was basically performing a lot of illegal abortions, and he was killing babies after they'd already been born. So that's what he was convicted of. He was convicted of murder.
Wow. And this is like one of the biggest, underreported crime sprees. Because I found out about this like maybe 2-3 years ago. I'd never even heard of the guy. So
yeah.
Here's what I as a filmmaker, just and I apologize. Like, is it? I don't know how do you make this just like instead of just being like sad and maudlin? Is it a thriller? Are we on the side of the cops and we're trying to track this guy down, or is it like? Inside the mind of a
it's a thriller. It's definitely a crime drama. It's all about how they caught him and how they prosecuted him. That's basically what it is. Because I just thought that any other way of going about it would just be too maudlin and would make the movie unwatchable.
Yeah, but,
you know, I wanted the story to get out there, but I did also want it to be something that people could actually sit through without losing their lunch. You know.
Yeah, so, that's a tough one. I mean, just as a subject matter. Now, did the producers like reach out to you? Or, like, it's tough, man. I don't know. Granted, you've done a boatload of films. I just named a handful, and you've been acting for a very long time. And most talented people eventually want to direct. But like, what made you say yes to this project?
Well, when they first contacted me, you know, I was a friend of theirs, and they just said, do you know anybody who might be interested in directing this film? And I gave them a couple of names, and those names didn't pan out. And they came back to me, and I said, well, you know, I did direct a film a few years ago. I might do it, depending on the script. You know, and I sent them a copy of the movie that I directed, and they asked me to come on board. And, yeah, I mean, after I read this, I was kind of tentative about it until I read the script. And when I read the script, I thought, okay, this is a story that needs to be told. And it's one of those rare instances where you can kind of participate in something that you actually think might be important, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and how are, I'm sure you, have you screened this for critics and what's the feedback been?
You know, it's been screened for a lot of different groups. The feedback has been very positive. They haven't screened it for critics. I know what the critics are going to say. I mean, you know, I'm not going to pay any attention to that, but it's been very well received by the audiences that have watched it.
So. That's fantastic. Now, was there like a breakout person for you? Now, I know you have to be somewhat political because you got a big cast, you got to be nice to everybody. But is there a performance in the film that just stands out where you're like, wow, I didn't know this guy or this girl just had it in them?
I would say both in the case of Dean Cain, who delivers a really gritty, down-to-earth performance that I haven't seen him do anything like this before, and he's really terrific in it. And Sarah Jane Morris, who's basically the lead in the film, she's the lead prosecutor, she really, it's a brave, touching, wonderful performance from her. And a lot of I have like 6 notes from different actresses in the movie who basically wrote me saying, thank you for giving me my first role. There's a lot of first-time actresses in this movie, and they all are pretty amazing. And a lot of that, of course, is due to me because I'm such a genius. But
I know you're joking around, but like that is a huge part of it. You don't want an adversarial role with your cast. They got to feel comfortable. They got to feel, you kind of have to shepherd them on this journey, but you got to get what you want out of it. I'd love to direct as well someday, but it's like such a daunting task. Like what was the biggest challenge?
Really time, the budget and the amount of time that we had to spend. That was the biggest challenge because, you know, we shot the movie in 21 days. And really, it should have been 30.
Yeah, but, that's like a Clint Eastwood schedule right there.
Yeah, it really is. It's like a TV movie schedule. But you know, back in the 80s when they made TV movies, you
know? They should bring those back.
Yeah, they should. I guess they can't figure out how to make that profitable anymore. But that was really the biggest challenge. Is you know, you got to get so much done in a day, and yeah. But thankfully, I had a great crew. I had a great DP, Mark Peterson, who did a fantastic job. And, you know, it really came together beautifully. I mean, I'm very proud of it. It's a nice.
I cannot wait to see it. I cannot wait to see it. Now I want to get to you a little bit as an actor. Some of the directors that you've worked with, insane. Barbara Streisand, Tony Scott, Robert Zemeckis. Holy smoke, Guillermo del Toro.
Yeah, well, of those that you mentioned, only Barbara Streisand is actually insane. But
what was she to work like? You guys, you were the Prince of Tides. You were the
No, she's perfectly nice. I was just kidding. It was a long time ago, and I was only there for one day. But in the movie, I basically have one scene where I'm at a party and I asked Nick Nolte to dance with me.
Yeah.
And Barbara Streisand, when I auditioned for the movie, I kind of came in like leather gear, like a lot of the other people that were auditioning for it were kind of preppy and nicely dressed. And I had on a leather cap, a tank top and a chain and stuff. And she kind of didn't get it when I did my audition. She said, she looked at me and she said, you know, I might want to use you for one of the rapists. And I think the story goes that she showed the tapes of the auditions to Nick Nolte, and Nick Nolte said, you should get the leather guy. So
Nolte, now was he nuts on that movie?
I had a great time with him. You know, the people that were in the scene with me were Nick Nolte and George Carlin.
Oh, so, my Lord.
Yeah, it was great. It was just...
I was what you call an extra, came very, very close to a speaking part in this movie called Teachers with Nick Nolte.
Yeah.
And he must have been going through something back then.
Yeah.
Because, wow. He was pajama pants and robe, and he was out there. Old Nick was out there. You know who does a great Nick? Kevin James does the best Nick Nolte impression ever in the history of ever. Yeah, okay, so, holy smoke. I saw Castaway in the movie theater, and I really did not like it at all, I just watched it again a couple weeks ago and, like, had an epiphany. I'm like, wow, I totally missed this movie. Like, I got it wrong. And I'm watching it, and then you show up in it. And, dude, I want to tell you what, and I tweeted about it. Like, that was a fantastic performance.
Oh, well, I appreciate that.
It's a very rare quality. I want to keep blowing smoke here just for a little bit longer. But it's like the everyman to me is the hardest thing for an actor to do. Like, and Robert Duvall would back me up on this. It's easy to play, oh, I'm paralyzed, I can only move my head. Oh, I'm blind, who's talking? You know, there's just like little tricks you can get away with. But dude, that was a fantastic performance in Castaway.
Well, you're very sweet. I appreciate that. It was great fun, and of course, an honor to work with Zemeckis and Hanks. And, you know, that came about, I think, partially. I had worked with Hanks a little bit on From the Earth to the Moon. He produced that, and I met him when I was working on that show.
Oh, I had it flipped. I thought you met Hanks on Castaway, and then you did, you were Deke Slayton, yeah?
Yeah, no, that came first. And From the Earth to the Moon was really, I was on that show for like 12 episodes, and I met everybody in Hollywood, I think. I met Hanks, and then I met Graham Yost. And then for 15 years after I did that, I was writing Graham Yost going, I thought you liked me. I thought we were friends. What? You're doing all this stuff, and you never cast me. And then finally he told me he gave me Justified just to shut me up.
Oh man, I haven't seen Justified. I gotta get into that. I'm a huge Timothy Oliphant fan. He was amazing. What was the series he did on HBO? Deadwood.
Yeah, he's all right.
He doesn't suck. He's got that. I can barely contain my rage thing down. I've never seen anybody do that. Just like, he's just so angry, and it's just simmering. It's fantastic.
Yeah, we had a great time on that show. Most of my stuff on the show, you'll see when you watch it. I mean, 90% of what I do on that show is talk to him.
So, okay.
But yeah, we had a great time.
Now, I just want to get this out there. You were also a series regular on Rodney with my old friend Rodney Carrington. I had no idea. Oh my God. I've been in Hollywood for a while. I've been fortunate enough. I've written on a few shows, blah, 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 blah. But like before any of that happened, I had met Rodney and I'd never seen anything like it. We were working at a comedy club in Louisville, Kentucky. And he just, there was like 25 people on the first night. He was so funny. I like my women like I like my chicken, just a little bit of fat on the end. He's doing his little songs. He's just a goofball.
Yeah.
He's just this oaky, goofball, lovable idiot. And just to watch the audience just grow and grow and grow until by Friday night, it was just standing room only. It was hilarious. So I moved out to LA. Oh, it's completely amazing. So I moved out to Hollywood. And then I'm doing stand up at like the improv in like in Phoenix or something. And Rodney's doing like a theater. He comes out to see. He ends his show, comes over to see my show, and he's like, "Do you ever move out to L.A.? They keep trying to convince me to go." Now, if you don't know Rodney, that's spot on.
Yeah, it is. It is.
They keep trying to get me to come out there, and I'm like, I went to the head of ABC, and I'm like, "What do you pay John Ritter? When you want to pay me what you pay John Ritter, then I'll do the dang show." And he was completely for real, and it worked. Yeah. It was hilarious.
Yeah, we did two seasons, and you know, when I met Rodney, I just auditioned for it and met him, and we did the pilot, and we just hit it off. We were really good friends right from the beginning, and I had never really heard of Rodney before. You know, I'd been in L.A. all this time, and
yeah.
I didn't know that he was such a big comedian out in the middle of the country. And after we got done, I was flying back to North Carolina, and he said, why don't you just come with me and you stop in I think we went to, I can't remember exactly, St. Louis. We went to St. Louis on his private jet to see his show.
Yeah.
And like, we go in and there's 5,000 people there and they know every word to every song. And I was like, oh my God, who is this man?
Exactly. See, here's the deal, Nick. You were living in a bubble.
Yeah.
And Rodney was out there in the middle of America. He's the Donald Trump of stand-ups.
I know. And he's still killing it. I mean, I just talked to him last week. He works every weekend and goes back home, and he says, man, I'm done with that L.A. stuff. I'm not ever coming out there ever again.
He is a genius. And oddly enough, you're a fantastic golfer. Rodney taught me to golf.
Yeah.
I never golfed. And he's always complaining about his wife. I the first day I met him, I tell you what, man, my wife just spends all my money. She just spends all my money. He didn't have a car. This is before he was huge. He didn't have a car. He's like, can you take me to the mall? Can you take me to the mall? It's white hat season. It's white hat. And I'm like, I take him to the mall, and the guy blows $300 on a white cowboy hat. I'm like, yeah, your wife's the problem. Your wife is the problem.
Yeah. Yeah. No, Rodney's a character for sure.
Hilarious.
And the other thing I directed was a music video for Rodney. So,
are you kidding me?
No, I did a music video for his song, If I'm the Only One. And he plays it now at all his concerts. He plays it in the pre-show.
That's fantastic, man. Now, but before I let you go, like, and this is fantastic, because and it gives me hope. Like, I'm on Twitter, I'm doing this Loftus Party thing and trying to maintain a career in Hollywood, and I see your tweets, and I'm like, okay, here's because, dude, I always hold back. Always hold back. I'm pumping the brakes 9 times out of 10 because I'm like, I don't. But like, you let it rip, dude.
Yeah, you're probably smart. You probably should. No, at a certain point, I think I just got to the point where it's like, okay, I'm not going to put up with this. I don't care. I'm going to be myself and let the chips fall where they may. And if somebody doesn't want to work with me because of my politics, then I probably wouldn't enjoy the experience anyway. So the hell with it, you know.
But has it gotten in the way ever? Have you like been on the set and someone says something and you bite your tongue? Has it ever been? Because like with me, like, I was writing on the old George Lopez show, the sitcom, and I had a producer. A buddy of mine said something about Bush, like in support of Bush, and this woman was like, I can't believe we've got Republicans on the staff. And me and my butt got really quiet really quick, you know?
Yeah, I know. Well, you know what? Everybody knows what my politics are, and I don't talk politics on the set. I mean, if somebody brings it up, I just go, you know, that's not something I'm willing to discuss here. I don't think it's the proper forum, unless you'd like to talk about Jesus, too. they sort of leave me alone after that. But, yeah, it's just a policy. You know, what I do on Twitter and, you know, when I speak on the radio or whatever I do, that's one thing. But I don't like the people that talk politics at work. I think it's rude. I think it's rude because there's a power imbalance there, and there's definitely people on the crew that are not going to speak up if one of the stars starts going on and on about what a racist Trump is or how awful Republicans are, you know, because a lot of the crew's mixed. The crew isn't 100% Democrat, but they can't, you know, that it's not fair. If they open their mouths, they'll get fired.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
So I just don't do that.
Okay, well, before I let you go, one more question. Did you ever turn down a part or lose out a part and just look back and go, man, I messed up. I wish I could have a do-over on that. Like, famously, like Tom Selleck was supposed to be Indiana Jones. James Caan turned down the lead in Kramer versus Kramer. Do you have one of those famous, like, the part that got away stories?
And no, I don't really. I think I must have accepted every part that somebody offered me.
That's fantastic.
I just went, okay, how much? you know, I might have turned a few things down because I didn't think there was enough money, or it was too far to travel, or it conflicted with something. But I never did turn down a role just because I didn't like it, you know.
Well, hey, that's cool. I am digging it. So what's next? Are you gonna go back to directing? Are you acting? What's next?
Well, I'm still acting once in a while, and I have a couple of projects that I'm developing. One's a wrestling script, and one is a script about gospel quartet music in the 60s, which, as you might imagine, is a really hot topic right now.
That's the one that's going to sell. That's the one that's going to sell, I'll tell you right now.
Right. But I do hope to direct some more. I've gotten to that age where most of the parts people offer me are kind of boring. They're the same things that I've already done. And it's like, you know, the old guys don't get to do that much unless you're Robert Duvall.
Well, so, dude, you are killing it. You're crushing it. Don't change anything. A fine, fine actor, a great director. Everybody, you need to go out and see Gosnell on October 12th.
Absolutely. So, that first weekend is key. Everybody go on opening day.
Yeah, you gotta make that algorithm happen. Let's beat the machine. Nick, thank you so much for being on the show, dude. Have a good one. I'll let you get back to golf, I'd love to talk to you in the future, brother.
Ladies and gentlemen, as sad as I am to say, that is going to conclude this particular very special episode of The Loftus Party. I hope you guys have enjoyed the episodes we've put together for you. Hope you guys have all had a great Monday, since this is typically when you listen to this particular bit of awesomeness. So, Michael and the Gypsy will be back next week. Look, if you like what they're doing, make sure you follow along. You can find The Loftus Party on Facebook. You can find them at theloftusparty.com. You can follow along with Michael on Twitter at @TheLoftusParty and the Gypsy on Twitter at @ScottsFire. And if you want, you can even follow along with yours truly. You can find me on pretty much every social media platform as either Rick Robinson or as RowdyRick73, or as Michael likes to call me, Kung Fu Rick. I'm going to get out of here. You guys enjoy the rest of your Monday. And like I said, the regular crew will be back next week, never fear.